welcome to Michael and Us. I'm Will Sloan, here as always with
Luke Savage. Welcome back, everyone.
So I just on Netflix watched the Jimmy Savile documentary.
Oh.
I know that you have seen.
Yes, I recommended it on a recent episode.
And I enjoyed it very much, found it very fascinating. I didn't know anything about Jimmy Savile. I knew that he was the Cosby of Britain and that he was apparently a beloved figure for many years.
Yeah, it's the Jimmy Savile story for, you know, non-British listeners or those who aren't familiar. It's kind of like, what if you found out that Mr. Rogers had been molesting children for half a century?
Just a guy who was on TV every day, had a million shows, and was also Mother Teresa or something. Like, he was a famous philanthropist. Anyway, I found this a very fascinating viewing experience. Just having never seen Jimmy Savile, it's fascinating always to be kind of immersed in this guy who arose in a particular time and place, a guy who is part of a particular context, and people lived with him for 50 years, and they had this ongoing conversation, you know, between performer and audience that lasted this long. And then to see the whole thing just as a complete outsider, I was watching these clips of Jimmy Savile thinking, this guy doesn't seem very appealing to me. He's not funny. He's not charming. Like, I don't get it. I mean, I guess I rationally do get it, because Jimmy Savile was a northerner perceived as a working class guy and a guy who carried a certain working class affect about him. He's a guy who, he was close chums with Margaret Thatcher, and he was knighted by the Queen and all that. And yet he, to his death, retained this sort of rough-hewn northerner's affect. And I guess in a society that is as paralyzed by class concerns as Britain, that would have resonated extremely strongly.
Well, if you're looking for a chaser for that documentary, there's two Louis Theroux, I guess, sort of one-hour specials you can watch. Because I guess in the early 2000s, one of the When Louis Met episodes, one of the episodes from that series is him meeting Jimmy Savile. And then, you know, after the revelations came out about Savile's extensive crimes, he did a second documentary, kind of follow-up one, kind of revisiting the first documentary. And I remember that being quite interesting.
Was he pro-Jimmy in the first documentary, basically? I mean, I guess he was this kind of secular saint in Britain.
It makes for kind of odd viewing, because from what I remember, he found Savile pretty charming. But then, because it's Louis Theroux and he was filming this documentary and he was able to spend so much time with him, he did get him in some candid moments where certain things come out that in retrospect, you know, he watches and he revisits in the second special and is like, well, it was dumb that I got taken in. We should have known. He's kind of wearing it on his sleeve.
It took a long time for Jimmy Savile to be knighted. Thatcher was campaigning for pretty much her entire tenure for him to be knighted. And only basically in the last year of Thatcher being PM was he knighted. And there's some suggestion in the documentary that there was wariness, like, oh, is this gonna come and bite us in the ass? And it's the time that he's knighted when the first suggestion that he might like little girls appears in print. And I still don't quite know, like, to what extent was this an open secret amongst the highest echelons of society?
Well, I gotta say, I don't really buy your theory, because the idea that the British ruling class has a problem bestowing honors on sex criminals doesn't really hold up to scrutiny.
I'm merely repeating what the documentary tells me and what I don't find credible about the documentary, which is that somebody in the documentary says it took them a really long time because they thought this was going to come back to haunt them. Why did they think this was going to come back to haunt them? I mean, yes, the ruling class has no problem with pedophiles, and yet this guy, apparently, before it even making it into print, apparently there was some thought that this guy's trouble. And they say that, yes, there were tabloid reports that he was a toxic boss or something. Like, he carried himself like a mafioso, and he liked to talk about having sex in his interviews. But, like, there seems something more there that people knew about that the documentary doesn't quite crack.
I think there's always been a kind of a weird openness. I mean, the elite of the Tory party especially, and, you know, other parts of Britain's ruling elite, I mean, they're constantly just, like, dabbing in front of everyone. You know, unlike their American equivalents, I think they're not really trying to cover it up. I mean, it was maybe, I don't know, 6 months ago, maybe it was a year ago, after all the Epstein stuff, it might have been during the Ghislaine Maxwell trial, that Boris Johnson's sister, while he was prime minister, wrote an article in, I think, The Spectator or The Telegraph that was basically just like, oh, I remember her from school and she was really charming. And oh, remember this time where, you know, I walked into the dining hall at Eton or whatever and she had her tongue in my brother's ear. And she's just like sharing that as a charming story and writing that in like a national paper.
Okay, so what I'm obviously trying to say is they knew that Jimmy Savile was doing this or something like this, or else he would have been knighted 10 years earlier. Why doesn't the documentary say this? Why can't the documentary say this? Why can't anyone say this?
I don't know, maybe for the same reason that in the Netflix Epstein documentary, anytime Bill Clinton comes up, there's like a little title card that's like, by the way, there's no evidence that Bill Clinton did anything wrong, and let's just all move on, folks. Well, I've got something from our side of the Atlantic here. I was going to ask you, did you see Joe Biden on Kimmel the other night? But, you know, that would be a stupid question.
I saw some tweets.
Okay, all right. That's more than I can say. I only saw it because of this article in Gawker. This is by Oliver Craighead.
Stuff like this is, quote, tweet bait. You know, he'll say something and then 500 people will quote tweet it.
Oh, man. Well, did he ever? And I just think this whole episode of Biden on Kimmel is so emblematic of the times in which we live. President Joe Biden was on Jimmy Kimmel Live last night to remind the American people that he is, in fact, alive. Held together by a facelift and a prayer, the president faced some pretty tough questions from the guy who used to host The Man Show and who put on an American flag lapel pin for the occasion. Kimmel opened with gun violence, asking the president, why haven't we done anything about this? Biden put the blame on, quote, intimidation by the NRA and the fact that the GOP is not your father's Republican Party, this is a MAGA party. Then he confusingly went on to praise Senator Mitch McConnell for being a guy who, when he says something, he means it. Like when he said we can't confirm a Supreme Court justice with a year left and then said the opposite, Kimmel asked. Biden did not have a good answer to this. Staying on guns, Kimmel asked if Biden could pass an executive order banning assault weapons, noting that Trump passed those out like Halloween candy. It's a good idea, one that a more bullish president would have done a week ago, but Biden just respects the laws of the land too darn much. I also get asked, look, the Republicans don't play it square. Why do you play it square? Biden said. Well, guess what? If we do the same thing they do, our democracy would literally be in jeopardy, and that is not a joke, Mr. President, sir. I hate to tell you this, but our democracy is already in jeopardy and you're being a pussy. Elsewhere in the interview, Kimmel asked the president why he's so optimistic about the country's future. You actually will never guess what he said. You turn on the TV, look at the ads. When was the last time you saw biracial couples on TV? He said. The phrasing of this is kind of confusing, but what he means is that we're on the right path because a biracial family can be used to sell Cheerios. I love progress. But so, I mean, I love that comment from Biden, the most emblematically Biden comment ever. The article, by the way, is called Joe Biden on Progress. We got biracial couples on TV. I love that so much because, you know, obviously, you know, Biden didn't get, you know, that's not like a political, they didn't pass legislation, be it resolved, that we're going to have biracial couples sell Cheerios. You know, it's like a development in the culture that they're celebrating as some kind of political victory. So that's one thing. But I feel like this is going to stick in my mind, this comment from Biden, because, you know, it comes at a time where, you know, his presidency is really coming apart at the seams. So much is going wrong. You have reproductive rights being rolled back, democratic liberties being curtailed in many states. You have this kind of ludicrous scare that the Republican Party has started up around school teachers and how they're grooming children. You have a mass shooting every few days. There are so many mass shootings that, you know, by the time a new one happens, you know, people have already forgotten the last one. You have just total political sclerosis. You have a president who's the leader of a party that raised expectations to the point where, you know, some people were convinced that there was a political transformation on the scale of the 1930s in the making. And, you know, obviously, I don't need to run through the litany of failures of the Biden administration so far, and the fact that there's just, you know, total legislative paralysis. And, you know, their message going into the midterms, which they're almost certainly going to lose very badly, is basically like, well, we can't do anything, but it's your sacred duty to vote for us. And if you don't, well, I guess you don't care too much about your neighbors. Biden was again and again, you know, sold to people as some kind of, you know, progressive figure, a surprisingly progressive figure. You know, he was an only Nixon can go to China type candidate. It's like, well, the reason Biden is going to be so progressive is actually because he's Biden. It's because, you know, he's such an unlikely candidate. candidate to bring about, you know, this political transformation. And here we are, you know, we're less than 2 years. I mean, we're barely over a year into the Biden presidency. His presidency is essentially over. There are articles appearing about, like, what the hell the Democrats are going to do in a few years. You know, who are they going to run? Is it going to be Buttigieg? You know, the vice president is so unpopular. It's going to be fun to watch them try to stick handle that. And I feel like Joe Biden is just the perfect avatar for the sclerosis of American culture and politics, you know, at this moment. He's the perfect avatar of imperial decline that refuses to recognize itself as such. There are constant mass shootings, democracy's being rolled back everywhere, and the president is on late night TV being like, well, the arc of history is long, but, you know, it bends towards, you know, you see a few more biracial couples in your Cheerios commercial. Anyway, there's nothing I can do to, you know, ban assault weapons. Vote for us in November. Thanks. The word gerontocracy has been thrown around a lot lately, partly because of that Dianne Feinstein article. But I mean, there could hardly be a better avatar for just an exhausted system that is desperately trying to cling to its sense of exceptionalism and the axiomatic belief that it's destined to lead the world. Well, you know, meanwhile, the political system is totally atrophied and the culture is just like pulling the copper wiring out of the walls. You know, the only good blockbuster in theaters is like a eulogy for everything it represents. It's like a eulogy for a more heroic time that at a certain point very soon is going to be impossible to still mythologize because even many elites no longer believe it.
Roratora Pharmaceutical, makers of the world's leading tablet for gas,
fascinating,
was in trouble.
My empire is crumbling!
They needed a new product.
We might be releasing the most effective antidepressant ever!
Go on.
They don't have my notes with me.
They needed it now.
Is it ready for production?
Yes, sir, it's ready to go.
Have there been any side effects?
Yes, sir, a few side effects.
Is this the result we're looking for?
Paramount Pictures and Lakeshore Entertainment present the first motion picture from the kids in the hall.
We think that everyone should have access to it, like ghetto children. Apparently their lives are horrible.
If you know them, you know what to expect.
Really kinky stuff, like two dogs making love with a cat.
If you don't...
Hey, you kids, get out from under that lady's dress.
We apologize in advance.
Our movie on this episode is 1996's Kids in the Hall, Brain Candy. The to-date only feature film spinoff of the beloved Canadian comedy series The Kids in the Hall. We've got a lot of requests for this one over the last couple weeks because The Kids in the Hall have reunited for a new Amazon show, which is very much positioned as a continuation of the show that they had from 1988 to 1995. I think we have different relationships with The Kids in the Hall, you and I. I'm curious to know if you have any at all.
Well, I don't really have one. I'm embarrassed to say I don't really know much about Kids in the Hall. I mean...
You're Canadian. What happened?
Well, I didn't really have TV growing up,
Fair enough, that's the reason. You see, I, as a kid, had the Comedy Network, which was a cable channel, which...
Yeah, oh, not all of us grew up in the suburbs with cable TV, Will.
And let me tell you, in Canada, there are Canadian content quotas. So every TV station has to show a certain amount of Canadian programming. And the Comedy Network, when that started in 1997, first of all, it was pretty cheap. So it could not afford the expense of Canadian shows. They used to play a lot of Jack Benny, believe it or not. Like literally, they would play stuff from the 1950s. That's how I found out about that kind of thing. And all of the Canadian stuff they would play would be, I mean, a lot of Red Green.
I did get the CBC. So Red Green. Air Farce. This hour is 22 minutes. The Rick Mercer Report.
A lot of open mic with Mike Bullard, Canada's talk show.
Do you ever watch Just for Laughs Gags?
I mean...
Let me tell you, that was good for some larfs.
I saw it, and I also certainly saw a lot of Just for Laughs, which was the TV version of the Montreal Comedy Festival, where you'd see, like, ooh, Howie Mandel's on doing a stand-up set. Ooh, it's Sinbad on TV now.
Yeah, but then those would be, like, the high-profile ones. Like, 95% of them would be people you'd never heard of. And then Just for Laughs Gags was, like, just the same bit over and over again, where it'd be, like practical jokes that were, frankly, like, cringeworthy to watch, where it'd be, like, you know, they put a mannequin behind a car and make it look like someone's getting dragged behind a car, and then they film all these people just genuinely horrified, and they're like, ah, smile, you're on Just for Laughs Gags. Awful.
Yeah, it was French-Canadian punked, basically. Yeah, they also had this like absolutely nauseating show that they would run every single day, several times a day, called Bazaar, which was this show that you didn't see this. This was a show that was made in like Toronto in the early 1980s, and it's distinguished as the show on which Super Dave Osborne was launched. But for the most part, it was just this like very smutty sketch comedy show where there were two versions of it. There was one where you could see the tits, and that would be on like the Showcase channel. And then there was one where the tits were censored, and that's what we saw on the Comedy Network. It was just like, imagine if Saturday Night Live was mixed with Benny Hill and was smuttier. And this was on every day, and it was Canadian, so it was on every day, and it was cheap to license, and I saw every single episode of it, I'm sure, and I never once liked it. Anyway, Kids in the Hall also showed a lot. Some of our American listeners, I'm sure, will have seen a lot of Kids in the Hall on Comedy Central, where it played in reruns a lot in the mid to late 90s. In fact, I think it's one of those shows that's probably more popular in reruns than it was when it actually aired originally. A little background on the Kids in the Hall, for those who don't know, since it is still a kind of culty comedy group. They began in the 80s in Toronto, where they performed weekly at the Rivoli, which is a bar on Queen Street that still exists to this day. They became sort of a buzzy show in Toronto, and they caught the attention of the talent scouts who worked for Lauren Michaels, the very powerful producer of Saturday Night Live. To make a long story very short, they became his kind of arty side project. He nurtured the group. He brokered a deal for a TV show that would be a co-production between the CBC and HBO in the US. And then he continued to advocate for it as it bounced between networks. It was always a bit of a ratings-challenged show. It's often compared to Monty Python. I think there's a lot to say about what's similar and different about the two groups. A commonality they have is that they're both supergroups of writer-performers with very different sensibilities. So Python, you had John Cleese and Graham Chapman, who wrote very traditional sketches. Man walks into an office, man walks into a pet store, that kind of thing. And there was a sort of beginning, middle, end to them. Whereas there was Michael Palin and Terry Jones, who wrote more absurdist Shaggy Dog pieces. And you can see Python as being this war between these two sensibilities. Kids in the Hall is very similar. You've got Dave Foley and Kevin MacDonald, who together, you know, an example of one of their great sketches is Citizen Kane, where there's a guy, they're sitting at a diner, there's a guy who's trying to tell his friend about the great movie he saw on TV last night, and he can't remember what it's called. It's about a newspaper tycoon. Oh, is it Citizen Kane? No, that's not it. Well, who's in it? Orson Welles, Joseph Cotten. It's Citizen Kane. No, that's not it. Well, what else happens in it? And it goes on from there. And then there's, on the other side, Mark McKinney and Bruce McCulloch, the latter of whom was the mastermind of a sketch called Love and Sausages, which is a long, surreal parody of Tarkovsky and other Eastern European art movies that has no actual jokes in it. It's just this very absurd sketch about this dystopian, oppressive society where they make sausages. Still a very divisive sketch among fans to this day. And then writing by himself was Scott Thompson, who will always be known as the gay one. I don't know if I can completely summarize the kids' comic sensibility, but one thing I'll say is there's a real bleakness in their vision. Friend of the podcast, John Semley, wrote a good book about them called This is a Book About the Kids in the Hall. And something he points out is that negative father figures are a recurring theme throughout their careers. Most of the troupe apparently had difficult fathers, and you'll see a lot of sketches on the show where fathers are depicted as abusive, alcoholic, philandering, threatening violence. In this movie we watched, one of my favorite scenes is the scene where there's the flashback of the kid and his dad comes home and just is like this defeated man, and he goes in and commits suicide. If I can quote from Semley here, "The anguish, confusion, and anger of growing up under the thumb of an alcoholic father is spun into comic gold by some remarkable Rumpelstiltskinian sorcery. This is what so much of comedy is, and especially what so much of the Kids in the Hall's comedy is. Gathering up the slings and arrows of misfortune that life volleys at you, and slinging them right back. Comedy is about turning pain and banality of existence against itself. Comedy is about beating up your drunk dad."
Man, I wish Semley was here right now, because he'd make a better second mic on this ep than I will. I really feel woefully underprepared for this, because besides watching the movie, I mean, I haven't really seen much Kids in the Hall at all. Again, in my defense, I basically didn't have TV growing up.
Don't worry, I'm not good on the Tony Benn episodes. It's okay. I think the other important thing to talk about with regards to their sensibility is sexuality. Obviously, sex is a very common topic for comedy, but I knew when I was a kid watching The Kids in the Hall that there was something very different about it. The show and the movie, I suppose, to a certain extent, are very sexually frank, but not in that laddish way that Monty Python or Bazaar were sexually frank. Like Monty Python, each group had one gay member, and that gave them license to traffic in a lot of queer and camp imagery. Monty Python used it to deflate the pomposity of British institutions. It's like, what if these two judges were gay? What if the military was gay? Wouldn't that be funny? You know, when they did their big reunion show in 2014, they were still doing those sketches. And I remember seeing it and thinking, like, you know, the one gay member has been dead for 30 years now. I'm not sure if this really flies anymore. And both groups use drag. And, you know, like Python, in The Kids in the Hall, you're supposed to basically accept them as women. Drag's not the joke. At least it's not the main joke. But the difference is that Python had Carol Cleveland, who would come in and she would play, like, the sexy women. She plays showgirls and women in bikinis and ditzy actresses and that sort of thing. And there's a rigid line between her characters and the screeching housewives that the Pythons played. But when The Kids in the Hall played women, they were often sexual women, and they didn't mind if you found them sexy in drag. Like, Dave Foley looks kind of cute in drag.
Well, Will has robbed me of what was going to be one of my only insights on this episode, which was, I was just going to observe that unlike in Monty Python, when Kids in the Hall dress up as women, they seem to really mean it. As you've already put it, the joke is not the drag. They're just playing women.
Well, something interesting is that Scott Thompson was not popular in the mainstream gay community when this show was actually running. He was often vilified in the gay press as perpetuating negative stereotypes for a heterosexual audience. There's a documentary out about The Kids in the Hall now on Amazon Prime, and it has a short but I think revealing interview with the gay journalist Michael Musto, who says words to the effect of, you know, I didn't like the character of Buddy Cole, but now I like him. Now I've come to realize that he's like a queer alpha. And, you know, it just goes to show, right, that, like, you know, if something lasts long enough, it eventually becomes respectable. You know, if the original culture war around the thing fades away. But I'm just going to quote from another book by Paul Myers called The Kids in the Hall and One Dumb Guy, who quotes Bruce McCulloch, who says, "Scott obviously wore the gay thing a lot, but I never wanted to be known as a gay comedy troupe because I thought that if we accepted the tag, we could be disregarded more easily. Besides, the fact was we weren't a gay comedy troupe. It was probably more significant that we were a group of mainly heterosexuals from the suburbs where homophobia is rampant, who could cross-dress and kiss each other on the lips and have no problem with it." Probably a lot to unpack in that statement. I'm not sure where you would place the group on the Kinsey scale after reading that statement, but that's how he regarded them.
I'm gay!
He's gay!
I'm gay!
He's gay!
So, Brain Candy came out after the TV show. The group was trying to follow the Python model, you know, have a TV show and then make a hit movie every couple of years. And it obviously wasn't a hit. It was a movie that was able to be made because after the success of Wayne's World, Lorne Michaels had a development deal at Paramount. From reading on it, it seems that the big bone of contention, the reason that the studio basically buried the movie, was the character of Cancer Boy. So you hadn't seen this movie. I'm curious what you thought of it.
I mean, I enjoyed it a lot. I think that the parts that made me laugh the most, though, kind of had often very little to do with the main plot. Like, they were just sometimes these little throwaway gags. Like, the part that I laughed the most at was a scene where just two of them are sitting in a car and they're talking about, like, something that was on the radio. And one of them says, "Do you see that segment about toast fucking? It's like a new thing where you fuck, or I don't know, you get fucked by toast." So I like the little absurdist elements like that. I like the boardroom scenes a lot, where just, like, you know, the corporate hacks are talking about the new drug they're developing, which is kind of the main narrative conceit of the film, just like stripped of all pretense. I thought that was pretty funny.
I kind of wanted to talk about this movie this week because there are certain threads in it that I feel are connected to Office Space last week. I'm not quite sure where I'm going with this, but we talked a lot on that episode about a certain kind of 90s wellness culture. We talked a lot about wellness culture that we've encountered at workplaces, how there's this sort of like, at least in some of the workplaces that we were in the past, there was this almost like oppressive, like turn that frown upside down vibe.
Well, you know, and it's funny because, you know, we both shared stories about that happening at past jobs that each of us had. I mean, several people chimed in on the Patreon with identical stories. I got a few more in the DMs. Someone was telling me a story about they worked at a, you know, progressive, like a liberal think tank or something. And then the day after Hillary lost in 2016, they had a meeting where everyone was supposed to cry, So there are lots of examples where, you know, the bosses, you know, make being vulnerable and, you know, being intimate with your coworkers a requirement. And I guess, you know, that's the political version of it. I guess I've actually come to think of it, experienced a version of that exact kind of thing myself. But yeah, clearly from the feedback we got, that's a very common experience. I mean, you mentioned kind of formless 90s positivity culture. I suppose because of what I've had on the brain of late, it caused me to think a lot about a type of sensibility, a type of aesthetic, a type of tone that I think you often see online, which I really associate with the past few years, which is also this one of sort of, you know, formless positivity, a sort of mawkishness. You know, I'd associate it with things like, you know, after Trump got elected, you know, like a few days after, people who are saying, well, this is the Fourth Reich in America are also doing tweets that are like, the ministry has fallen. And it's like, there's no irony about it. It's like, that's actually how they're relating to the world. You know, everybody talks about how negative and acrimonious the culture of the internet's become. And of course, that's true. But the flip side of it, I mean, the real character of the internet and of social media especially, is that the tone always trends towards hyperbole in one direction or the other. It doesn't have to be negative. It doesn't have to be nastiness. The flip side of that is that there can just be kind of formless and bland positivity as well. And I feel like that sensibility has kind of seeped into the culture, you know, just as much and into kind of the rhetorical style and the kind of parlance of many adults and professionals as well. I mean, another thing we talked about on the Office Space episode that's related to this is just the kind of odd infantilization of everything. And relatedly, we got some additional feedback on that episode about that. I can't remember the name of the listener, was talking about somewhere they worked where, you know, they were shown videos constantly, like I think on a monthly basis, of the long dead founder.
Sort of an L. Ron Hubbard-like figure.
Yeah, something like that. But, you know, kind of all happening in the context of this office culture where, you know, the tone of everything was like the same as you'd find in a children's show or something.
The flip side to formless 90s positivity is a certain kind of formless 90s nihilism or negativity that, I mean, tell me if this seems like too broad a generalization or too broad a grouping, but like there's a particular sensibility embodied by like Vice magazine and Howard Stern and certain kinds of like punk rock.
Or who is the schlock rocker that we discussed?
Oh, yeah, that fucking guy, El Duce. And this movie satirizes that as well to a certain extent in its punk rock character. So the film is a broad satire of America and her ills.
Clearly filmed in Toronto.
Yeah, and it was honestly great to see Yonge Street back in the day. Like, it was great to see Sam the Record Man. It chiefly targets corporate greed and the pharmaceutical industry. It makes detours into many other subjects. We meet many different archetypes. There's the punk rock character. There's a closeted suburban father. There's a vapid talk show host. There is Cancer Boy, who is the movie's most controversial character.
Right. So as I understand it, this was a character who originally appeared in the last episode of the TV show, the Kids in the Hall sketch show. And I didn't have time to look up the bit, but I guess the idea of it was that the character was about being as offensive as possible. And it sounds like they later regretted putting him in the movie. But from what I read about it, it doesn't sound like that's because they actually, you know, thought the character wasn't defensible. It was because they fought with Paramount very hard to keep him in the movie. And then they felt later on that, you know, their fight with Paramount caused the studio to be pretty diffident in its marketing of the film.
Hello.
Hi, Doctor. I'm Cancer Boy.
And what would you like to say to the doctor?
I'd like to thank you for your marvelous drug.
Oh, are you on it, Cancer Boy?
No, there is no hope for me. But my parents are on it, though. They were so very low, not just because of me, but because my brother was born with his heart on the outside of his body.
I mean, it's a pretty tough character. The inspiration for it is all those charities. I mean, you know, the Jerry Lewis Telethon, which was on every year, would always have like a poster child who is this little boy or girl with muscular dystrophy who would always be like, in fact, they would call them the poster child and they'd be brought out every year. And
yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's because I grew up in the 90s, but that's how it immediately scanned for me. It just seemed to be so clearly a parody of, again, this kind of bland, formless positivity that was everywhere. Or yeah, like you'd have, you know, TV specials, telethons, whatever, where they have, you know, a really sick child or something. And, you know, his line, which I guess was very controversial, which is he says something like, oh, it's okay, you know, my marrow is low or something like that. I mean, that almost sounds like something you might have seen in one of those telethons. So I just read it as a parody of that.
It's a tricky thing, I guess, when you're dealing with people who aren't funny in the studio office, who are saying, why are you making fun of children with cancer? You know, we love these brave little boys and girls on the telethon. You know, I mean, it's absurd that you have to explain the joke to those people, but you know, I guess apparently they did. The plot of the movie, though, essentially, and you know, there may not even be that much to say about it, but the inspiration was the big Prozac craze of the 90s. You know, Prozac, the antidepressant, began being widely prescribed in the 90s. Some thought it was being overprescribed. Elizabeth Wurtzel's novel Prozac Nation is one of the most famous artifacts of that particular culture war issue. And the thesis of the movie, if it has one, is Prozac, but not just Prozac, just general positivity culture is being overprescribed, is being enforced on people in a way that's unhealthy. And we need to be comfortable with difficult and negative emotions as well as happy emotions, because that's what living life is all about.
Well, and the conceit of the drug is that it basically locates chemically in your brain your happiest moment, and then it kind of like creates a homeostasis of a kind around the emotions associated with that. So it also makes for a good comic device, because you constantly get to see people, you know, flashing back to their happiest moments.
And there's a bit of, I think, Terry Gilliam's Brazil in the second half of the movie, where the drug goes haywire and people are like frozen like statues in their best moments. It's as if, like the hero of Brazil, they've escaped this horrible world and retreated into this world of dreams. I will say that this movie comes, I think, from a very different era of discourse around mental health and wellness, because, you know, the idea that you're not supposed to be happy all the time is now so popular that there's been a Disney Pixar movie about it called Inside Out. And corporations have gotten so much more savvy about this kind of thing. Corporations in all their health and wellness initiatives are always saying, you know, it's okay to feel bad. You know, as you say, they're getting people in a drum circle to cry about Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, losing. Right. It's okay to feel bad. Just don't you dare complain about your wages.
Exactly.
Or try to form a union, or we will literally hire mobsters to fucking kill you.
And in fact, if you feel bad, like, first of all, that's your problem. But good news, we've got a bunch of resources available for you now so that you can deal with your problem.
Right. It's like, don't worry, we see you, we hear you. We're not going to pay you more or do anything else that might alleviate, you know, the material underpinnings of your mental health crisis.
But we've got some therapy dogs here, and you can cuddle with them and snuggle with them.
Right. And on top of this, you know, you also have like every TV show. I mean, and I'm not talking about, you know, Netflix prestige dramas. I'm talking about the shows that probably many more people actually watch, like network dramas and stuff. All those shows now are just like,
it's about trauma.
Yeah. They're marketed to people that make $300,000 a year and have like 5 vacations every year. And the message of every single one of them is like, you know, it's okay to feel sad.
Every cartoon show is about how Steven Universe is dealing with depression on this episode. You know, Paddington Bear is dealing with the trauma of the immigration system, but it's okay.
George Bush has mental health.
By the way, before we leave this topic, I do want to share the Siskel and Ebert review of this movie for
you. It's very insightful. It will tell you a lot about the movie.
Okay, let's just play it right now.
Brain Candy will appeal to young moviegoers who are fans of Kids in the Hall. I've seen them a couple of times on late night TV, and I often thought they seem good only by comparison with the recent Saturday Night Live troupes. But in Brain Candy, they're funnier than they've ever been on TV. And I recommend this picture as kind of a midnight show cult picture, which I suspect it's destined to become.
Boy, are we apart on this one. Oh. I did not laugh once. I thought movie was awful.
Oh, no, Roger.
Dreadful.
No.
Terrible.
No.
Stupid. Idiotic.
No.
Unfunny.
No.
Labored. Forced.
Oh, Roger.
Painful.
Roger, this is
bad.
What happened to your sense of humor?
I got my sense of humor. That was what my sense of humor was, starving for a laugh.
Oh, no, Roger. First of all, the drag stuff was funny.
So what?
Wait, okay. So what? If it's funny.
Why is it funny that they're in drag?
It's not funny that they're in drag.
No,
I've knocked pictures where people have been in drag when they're not funny. Obviously,
they're not funny.
You didn't get the stuff about the drug and
I caught on.
Happened, Roger?
We're different universes here. We can't talk about it. Can't talk about it. It's not funny. I didn't laugh
once. We get paid to talk about it, Roger.
Okay.
Let's talk about it.
Tell me one funny moment in the movie.
There are dozens of funny moments. Every time I
choose one.
Every single time, I laughed throughout the picture.
Okay.
I laughed throughout the picture.
Well, I'm happy for you.
No. But, at least it's a start. It's a smile. Roger, will you look at this picture again?
Sure I will. I'll be happy to. Sometime, maybe in the 21st century. When we come back.
Didn't you learn so much?
Razor sharp analysis. So there was a reading series that I had in mind for this week anyway, and I didn't really plan this, but it gels perfectly. It syncs perfectly with much of what we've been talking about. This is probably the most memorable thing I read this week, of all places in the Times, the British Times, that is. That's a clarification Will made me insert, by the way. It's by a writer called James Marriott, who I'm not familiar with. It's called The Ugly Truth About the Triumph of Twee, the distinctive style of our age is childlike and silly, and the big corporations are exploiting it. It's not very long, so I think I'm going to take us through the whole thing here. Feel free to jump in if you have any comment. Waking to the news that a massed formation of 400 drones had flown over Buckingham Palace in the shape of a smiling corgi 600 feet high, I reached skeptically for my phone. I spent the Jubilee weekend in Budapest, and reports of the celebrations back home reached me confusedly. Few of them sounded credible. Paddington Bear assaulted a member of the palace catering staff. The Queen played We Will Rock You on a teapot. A drone corgi. There it was, luminous and sinister, dominating the nighttime sky over London. I watched the footage with awe, obviously, at the sheer airborne scale of the corgi, but also awe at this almost imperial triumph of Twee. Twee is overnice, precious, and mawkish, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, which cites the phrase, quote, as nauseatingly twee as the worst of Disney. Justly, the sugary whiff of Disney is the best evidence of twee. Once culturally marginal, a series of aesthetic mannerisms associated with greeting cards and downmarket children's books, twee is now the establishment style.
I thought this was going to be a bad article that you were reading, but this is actually very true.
When the Queen was presented to her subjects at the coronation 70 years ago, the emphasis was on dignity and mystery. Uniformed soldiers, a naval review, the BBC's cameras forbidden from capturing the sovereign's face in close-up. In the 1950s, this was still the language of power.
I mean, God, I don't miss the reverence of not being allowed to photograph the Queen's face in close-up.
I think all that really matters here is that the semiotics of power, the aesthetic of power, has changed. It was one thing, and now it's another thing. Now, I suppose because this is the Times, it's possible, I'm not familiar with this writer, so it's possible that certainly readers of the Times will have that scan in a nostalgic way, but I'm not sure that's how it's intended. Anyway, he continues, in the 1950s, this was still the language of power, formal, pompous, sternly detached. Parading for the Queen in 2022 were Teletubbies, a man in a Shaun the Sheep costume, women dressed as afternoon tea, a towering motorized cake. I mean, for me, what a lot of this says is, I think back to that article of mine that I think we discussed, a year ago, after Harry and Meghan did their big Oprah interview. I mean, to me, this partly is about the decline of the monarchy, right? It's about how the idea of monarchy, its premises just aren't really sustainable in our hyper-capitalist, market society. And in an age when Britain is no longer, an imperial hegemon.
And so the only way to make it work is it's like, well, you should act like a funny Disney character, which is what you are. you're the queen in a Disney movie. Now have lunch with Paddington.
None of this, he continues, is the invention of monarchy. The organizers of the Jubilee pageant understood that modern power clothes itself in twee. In a recent video, Mark Zuckerberg guided viewers around the metaverse, the virtual reality universe where he hopes we will one day live for his profit in the guise of an adorable cartoon avatar of himself. Last year, Elon Musk changed his job title to Techno King of Tesla. On Twitter, he promotes Dogecoin, a cryptocurrency symbolized by a smiling, overweight dog. When the state or large corporations wish to communicate with us, they soften the interaction by using the language and conventions of twee. Renewing my Vodafone contract last week, I was instructed to pour out my grievances to Toby, an insipid, helmeted digital assistant who looks like he has been expelled from a Mario Kart game and condemned to office work. Returning from Budapest, I was guided through the electronic passport gate by a video of an animated plasticine man. Twee is now a cultural default, the distinctive style of our age. Our emojis, GIFs, and memes will mark us as surely to the generations of the future as the wing collars, tailcoats, and elaborate ceremonies of social deference marked our ancestors. Grown-up men and women love Disney and Harry Potter. In Charlie McKessie's interminably best-selling The Boy, the Mole, the Fox, and the Horse, the characters advise each other that help is the bravest word, and everyone is a bit scared. The most prominent symbol of the modern far right is a cartoon frog named Pepe. Twee is peculiarly modern. The past had little notion of twee. Consider the harshness and ugliness of the babies and animals painted by Renaissance masters. Its present apogee is often attributed to a desire for comfort amid the uncertainty of our times. This seems inadequate. Most of history has been uncertain. The war-shadowed 1930s was an intensely serious decade. The roots of twee stretch in many directions. Americanization is part of it, I think. So is the 1960s and 1970s obsession with the naive wisdom of children and the idea that we all have an inner child with whom we must get in touch. Most important, perhaps, is the egalitarian spirit that has led to the decline of old-fashioned highbrow snobberies about elite cultural forms such as classical music and poetry. I arrived at university with obnoxious provincial fantasies of philosophical discussion and discovered, alas, a flourishing Disney society. Childhood is the universal experience, and the culture of children is the most widely shared. Who hasn't seen a Disney film? A love of childish things is a mark of democratic taste and an aversion to pomposity. Britain, with its long, often admirable, tradition of anti-intellectualism is especially vulnerable. I can't bring myself to hate Paddington and corgis, but twee can be as oppressive as the formal serious culture that preceded it. Right, so just, I think, further to my point from earlier about how I don't think he was exactly, I don't think he's setting out to kind of memorialize or eulogize the more pompous and kind of removed aesthetic of, you know, the monarchy in the 1950s. I think it's really just a comparative study of the two. He continues, "If our ancestors denied themselves the silly childlike side of human nature, we now ourselves deny its solemn and difficult aspects." So, I mean, basically the thesis of Brain Candy right there. Twee is an aesthetic for an age uninterested in ethical complexity, which prefers good and bad as neatly separated as they are at Hogwarts. It fits the childish behavior of social media's most active users, who swing between condemnatory temper tantrums and cooing over anthropomorphized animals. Most of all, I'm suspicious of how easily twee has been appropriated by powerful corporations. It's easier to rip someone off with a smiling, wide-eyed chatbot. A whimsical techno-king sounds more benign than a cigar-wielding industrialist. An illusion, of course. Decades ago, an older generation grew suspicious of the way deference, sober suits, and formal manners hid wrongdoing and the abuse of power. Today, we must learn to be just as suspicious of the hypocrisy and concealment of cartoons, fluffy animals, and the vapid injunctions to be kind. So, you know, very interesting article, great writing as well.
Is it too much of a stretch for me to draw some sort of connection between what you just read and what I was saying a couple minutes ago about how corporate culture now encourages us to be in touch with our feelings and embrace the sadness? Like this twee style that the author alleges has become the house style of the ruling class seems like this sort of calculated concession that has been made in a time of like vast decline. It's like, okay, well, during this time we can't be serious and stolid, but we can be silly. We can come down to your level and be silly with you, and that'll ease the pain of all this.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, there's the passage about in the piece about how, you know, this, you know, love of childish things is a mark of democratic taste and an aversion to pomposity. And he means that, you know, in a performative sense. It's a way for powerful people, corporations, you know, individuals, whatever, to signal or kind of perform some kind of, you know, fake democratic sensibility. I mean, you know, it's how you get like union busting firms that also specialize in doing, you know, mental health seminars and things like that. And I mean, the piece brought up Elon Musk, and, you know, he's a good example of this. And, you know, in some ways, I hadn't really thought about him in this way, and I'm going to have to mull this over. I mean, it's always struck me that Elon Musk's whole shtick is actually potentially a big liability for the richest man in the world. I mean, so much of the sensibility I associate with billionaires, with plutocrats, it's closer to somebody like Bill Gates or something like that. I mean, somebody who has this very manicured, kind of airbrushed image, who speaks about things with this kind of performative expertise, who's always playing kind of the sober, concerned expert in a way that's, you know, designed to, you know, it's there to get you to forget that, like, well, Bill Gates is actually just, you know, he's just an oligarch, you know? And I always thought that, you know, Musk is kind of, you know, what he's doing almost kind of desacralizes that image. I mean, he's fucking plugging Dogecoin. He's on Twitter just getting into the stupidest fucking fights with people. And the argument of this piece actually causes me to think about that a little bit differently. If, as the author says, you know, twee is the new language, you know, it's the new kind of aesthetic of power and hierarchy, then what Musk's doing, you know, really makes sense. It's really in sync with that. And I mean, the absurd and I mean, really contemptible fandom around him does seem to be an extension of it. The people who seem to really like Elon Musk, I mean, they don't think about him like he's not really a rich guy. I mean, that's not first and foremost how they think about him. Like, he's a really cool guy, you know, he's just a really cool dude who posts on Reddit, you know, and, you know, I don't think he's, you know, I don't think he's doing this consciously. I mean, he definitely just is that. I mean, not a cool dude, but like, he's like a C-tier Reddit shit poster, basically. But I don't know, this puts his cringe in a whole new perspective. I mean, I also think the piece makes an important point that we discussed earlier when talking about brain candy, you know, which is this whole point about kind of ethical simplicity and how that's kind of suffused everything now. I mean, not to belabor this, but I mean, I constantly am given cause to think back to those posts. I mean, do you remember just like the week after Trump was elected and just like how many people were doing posts, you know? I mean, there was that ministry as fallen post. There was one where it was like a guy, I mean, I guess he was dressed as Dumbledore. He had a long beard and he was holding this sign. This was like a viral lib Twitter post. And the guy is like holding a sign that says something like, you know, if you've ever answered the call of the Mockingjay, if you've ever wanted to be in Dumbledore's army, you know, just like a list of like shit like that. It's like, you know, now is the time. Like, now is your time to step up. And it's like, I'm sorry, is this the Fourth Reich in America? Or is this an occasion that warrants these kind of references? I actually have a folder on my computer. I haven't checked it for a while, but it's called Liberalism versus Trump. There was a while where I was just like documenting things like this. I just clicked on a couple random ones. This was an article. It's from Cosmopolitan, piece of clickbait they published, I guess, in, you know, November, December 2016. Celebrities dramatically perform I Will Survive in honor of the impending inauguration. And then, I don't know, there's Matthew McConaughey, Emma Stone. I don't recognize the others. This was a headline. Green Day's Billy Joe Armstrong on Trump. The Harry Potter generation will defeat evil. Anyway, I don't have time to go through all of them, and I don't want to go down too much of a trip down memory lane here. There's a lot of awful shit. The point is, a lot of it had to do specifically with Harry Potter, and I don't think that's exactly an accident. I mean, the morality of the Harry Potter universe is so simple. It's so binary, right? And not to beat up too much on Harry Potter fandom here.
Which is having a hard enough time already right now.
Yeah, constantly besieged Harry Potter fandom. But I mean, I think one of the things about our current era, you know, because of social media in particular, is that it does just kind of tend towards these, you know, hyperbolic extremes that may be different in sensibility, but are equally reductive. I think one of them that the article on Twee I just read is identifying is more associated with kind of liberal institutions. I mean, it's obviously talking about the monarchy and the Jubilee, which is hardly a liberal institution. I mean, liberal institutions in the broadest sense, kind of in the small L sense. And specifically, I'm thinking about American liberal institutions here. The kind of things we've been talking about already. The fact that there are mega corporations that will talk about, you know, mental health and wellness and stuff like that, and then are just like utterly brutal to their majority POC workforce or whatever. So that's one of the sensibilities. But then, you know, on the flip side, right, you have something like MAGA or the alt-right, where in its own way, it kind of reflects many of the same things. I mean, the author mentioned Pepe the Frog. You know, it's kind of kitsch. It's almost campy. There's a kind of a burlesque quality to it. But then the sensibility, far from being sort of mawkish and vulnerable, is in many ways, you know, the exact opposite of those things. You know, it's nasty and cruel, and it's really reveling in those things. So much of the appeal of those Trump rallies, you know, particularly those early Trump rallies in 2015 and 2016, was just, you know, providing an outlet for people where they were sort of just given permission to like feel really, really good about being, you know, nasty to different groups of people they hated. And I think in its own way, that is kind of a reflection of something at least related to what the author is talking about. You know, that's reactionary twee. But I mean, just to go back to where this episode began, you know, everything is crumbling. And, you know, the president of the United States is going on late night TV to be like, don't worry, be happy, Mac. You know, there's a biracial couple in the Cheerios commercial.
These are the days I know, I know. These are the days I know. These are the days I know, I know. These are the days I know.
We are the days he knows, he knows. We are the days he knows. We are the days he knows, he knows. We are the days he knows. Some of us are days,
but most of us are days.
We all have our own hands, but we come from different moms.
These are the days I know, I know.
We are the days he knows.
Now these are the days.